Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the hepatitis A outbreak in the state, Brandon Smith reports on the Donnelly Braun Senate race, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Caleb Wilson loved trains, and his little sister Ellie loved her brother. Caleb 3 and Ellie 2 were struck by an eastbound freight train about 9:30 a.m. Tuesday morning. Caleb was pronounced dead at the scene, and Ellie was airlifted to University of Chicago Comer's Children's Hospital in Chicago in critical condition. The children's aunt, Destiny Lewis, told the Times early Tuesday evening that Ellie was awake and talking. They are the children of Kelsey Benson and Jacob Wilson. Police are continuing to investigate, but Police Chief Troy Williams said family members believe the two sneaked out of the home through a screen door without the adults' knowledge. The adults were actively searching for the toddlers when the collision occurred. Williams said Officer Laura Lightfoot was the first on the scene. Caleb was found deceased, while Ellie was found crying and with noticeable injuries. The Mobile Park home is just south of US 20. It backs up to the CSX tracks. The only separation between the park is a steep, wheat-filled embankment. The family lived about four mobile homes from the tracks. Portage Police, Indiana State Police, Porter County Coroner's Office, Portage Fire Department, Burns Harbor Police, Ogden Dunes Police, and CXX Railroad Police were involved in the investigation. Police Chief Williams lauded the teamwork of emergency responders in the tragedy. The accident also blocked several CXX crossings in Portage for several hours as the investigation continued. A spokesperson from CXX Railroad said the train involved in the incident was owned by Norfolk Southern Railroad, traveling the CXX tracks on a temporary operating agreement. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A Northwest Indiana man accused of killing his 94-year-old mother in a 2015 fire at their house is scheduled for trial this fall after a judge allowed him to withdraw his insanity defense. Porter Superior Court Judge Jeffrey Clymer said he based his ruling in part on answers from 70-year-old Frederick Fegley during a Wednesday hearing. Fegley said he's taking medications for a, quote, thought disorder while he's jailed. The trial is scheduled for October 1st. Fegley had been committed to a state psychiatric hospital after evaluations determined in 2016 he was incompetent to stand trial. Wanda Maxine Wonder was found in an upstairs bedroom of the Ogden Dunes home in April 2015. She died of smoke and soot inhalation and thermal injuries. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. President Trump's nominee to lead the Superfund program says he'll recuse himself from sites contaminated by his former employer, DuPont. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Teal reports, 11 of those sites are in Indiana.
For nearly two decades, Peter Wright served as legal counsel for Dow Chemical Company, which merged with DuPont last year. In a statement, he agreed to sell his stock in the company and recuse himself from about 300 hazardous waste cleanups where it was the responsible party. Jim Barnes teaches environmental law at Indiana University and worked at the EPA for about 20 years. He says he's pleased that Wright recognized how his connection to Dow DuPont might be perceived.
That is not something that many of the members of the current administration, I think, have been sensitive to.
Barnes says Wright also likely has more experience with the complex Superfund program. Two EPA deputy assistant administrators would take over cases where Wright might have a conflict of interest. The EPA refused interviews for this story. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Religious conservative groups that oppose hate crimes laws in Indiana say Governor Eric Holcomb's support for the measure won't matter. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports one of those groups also has a warning for the Republican governor.
One of those groups also has a warning for the Republican governor. Brother Rebecca. Brother Rebecca. Brother Rebecca.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly says he supports sanctions on Iran that just took effect. But the Hoosier Democrat also defends the Iran nuclear deal entered into during President Obama's term, an agreement President Trump withdrew from earlier this year. Donnelly says he supports any effort to ensure the Middle Eastern nation doesn't possess nuclear weapons. And he says the Iran nuclear deal aided that effort.
And the inspections that took place, Secretary Mattis, our defense secretary, said that the inspections were robust, they were strong.
Donnelly says the recent sanctions are a good backup plan. Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun criticizes Donnelly for his support for President Obama's agreement with Iran. In a statement, Braun spokesperson Josh Kelly says the GOP Senate hopeful supports President Trump's decision to reimpose sanctions against what he calls the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Anti-abortion groups want to put pressure on Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly to vote for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on a demonstration Monday outside Donnelly's Indianapolis office.
On a demonstration day outside Donnelly's Indianapolis office.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Democratic incumbent U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly talked about health care on the campaign trail last Friday as he makes his pitch for re-election. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Democrats are seizing on the issue in what they hope is a winning strategy this election cycle.
Hoosier Republicans didn't lose many elections in recent years when they ran on pledges to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but Congress spent the last year and a half trying and mostly failing to do away with the law and replace it with a new system. Senator Joe Donnelly says voters notice.
It's contributed to the problems that we have in health care, where you look and there's questions about whether pre-existing condition coverage will continue.
Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun is clear. He wants to dismantle the ACA. He says the challenge is a replacement.
Typical liberal or the Democrat plan is whatever it costs, try to do it. That's played out in front of us and it's falling apart.
Braun says conservatives don't talk enough about the need for reform within the healthcare insurance industry. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. U.S. Senator Todd Young says while he supports President Donald Trump standing up to capitalist nations like China on trade, he also wants a more targeted strategy for international tariffs. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Stephanie Weichman reports.
I'm very much aware. Indiana is the most manufacturing intensive state in the country. We don't want to disrupt our global supply chains. That's happening already.
Republican U.S. Senator Todd Young says while he's behind the mission of imposing tariffs to bring about better trade behavior, he's anxious about the Trump administration's approach because there isn't an on-paper strategy to review. He says he's asked for one.
That's coherent, that's cohesive, that's comprehensive. Call it a national economic security strategy, just like we have a national security strategy. It's written, there's a classified annex, of course, but that is developed across different departments of government.
Some Indiana manufacturing businesses, like engine maker Cummins, say tariffs on supplies and goods, both from the U.S. and retaliatory ones from other countries, along with increased commodity prices, could end up costing them millions more a year. Young also wants the U.S. to partner with G7 countries to get the most leverage out of trade decisions. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Stephanie Weekman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana's top election official blasted Attorney General Curtis Hill for trying to stop plans to add more early voting sites in Marion County. Secretary of State Connie Lawson said Wednesday that, quote, reckless actions by her fellow Republican disrupted months of bipartisan planning. Neighboring counties have multiple early voting sites, but Indianapolis only had one until advocacy groups sued. A federal judge recently approved a plan to settle the suit by adding more sites. Then, he'll file court papers challenging that plan. He says he doesn't oppose early votes in Marion County, but says that decision should be left to the county's election board, not the courts. Hill separately is facing calls to resign from high-profile Republicans, including Lawson, after four women accused him of sexual misconduct, which he denies. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. As students head back to school, the state wants them to be better protected from hepatitis A. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports, Indiana is one of several states experiencing an outbreak.
All 6th and 12th graders are required to have a hepatitis A vaccination on the books before coming to school this year. It's a new requirement from the state in response to an outbreak of hepatitis A. The Indiana Department of Health's Director of Immunizations, Dave McCormick, says the addition aligns with other required vaccines kids need.
So Hep A was added at the 12th grade visit and also the 6th grade visit, because there were other touch points for other vaccines.
The state already requires the vaccine for kids in kindergarten through fourth grade. Indiana usually sees an average of 20 cases of Hep A a year, but 13 counties have reported at least 5 cases of hepatitis A since November, with a statewide total of more than 300. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The state is moving forward with plans to stop posting air pollution notices in newspapers, despite opposition. The notices let people know if someone has applied for a permit to put contamination into the air. Now, the majority of those would be online or sent via email. The Environmental Rules Board voted Wednesday to preliminarily adopt the proposed change. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management says newspaper readership is down and those printed notices cost the state nearly $60,000 a year. More than half of that is staff time. Staff employees say they've had issues with posting delays and fees. Stephen Key is the executive director for the Hoosier State Press Association. He says he understands IDEM's frustration, but that the public needs these notices in their local newspapers.
And the Hoosier State Press Association stands ready and willing to work with IDEM to help with those service issues.
Key says the Press Association has resolved similar problems with the State Alcohol and Tobacco Commission. IDEM has received more than 600 comments asking the state to continue publishing air pollution notices in newspapers. The Environmental Rules Board expects to vote on the final rule at its next meeting on November 14th. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Dozens of police officers have escorted the son of a slain Central Indiana police officer to his first day of first grade. Southport Police Lieutenant Aaron Allen was fatally shot July 27, 2017, hours after he held his son Aaron Jr.'s hand and walked him to a bus stop for his first day of kindergarten. Police from several agencies lined the street Wednesday while Southport Police Chief Tom Vaughn drove Aaron Jr. to school. Vaughn says, quote, "We wanted little Aaron to know he is part of a huge family and we are going to be there for him." Aaron Jr., his mother Stacy, and some friends rode in Vaughn's car. Vaughn says the boys smile and watch cartoons during the ride. Lieutenant Allen was shot helping a driver after a crash. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Industrial hemp is still illegal to grow in Indiana, outside the research sector. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, some Hoosiers who attended a summer study committee Monday are pushing legislators to change that law.
Dozens of Hoosiers told the committee they think industrial hemp should be legal to be grown in state. Matt Alvord is vice president of Angola, Indiana-based health food company Foods Alive. He says it hurts him to not be able to purchase hemp, which his company already makes into food, closer to home.
It makes up about 20% of the sales that we have. I'd be happy to tell you that that dollar amount is in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. We are forced to purchase all that raw material from Canada.
Last session, a bill that would have permitted industrial hemp growing failed in the Indiana Senate. Summer Study Chair and Brookston Representative Don Leahy says he recognizes there's a demand for hemp in Indiana. The committee's next meeting is tentatively scheduled for the first half of September. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Construction crews working on I-69 are preparing for an influx of traffic as Indiana University students begin moving in. The Indiana Department of Transportation is in the final stages of construction of a 21-mile section of the highway between Bloomington and Martinsville. The Herald Times reports that the Transportation Department is trying to finish work on two overpasses in Bloomington that are considered choke points for traffic. University spokesman Chuck Carney says the bulk of the school's more than 40,000 students are expected to arrive next week. There will still be lane restrictions on the north end of the project. Transportation Department spokesman Andy Dietrich says commuters can avoid the area using two alternative routes. Contractors are trying to meet an August 31st target of substantial completion. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Brandon Warren is an 18-year-old from Indianapolis who became an anti-violence activist after he lost a friend. He was recently recognized as one of the nation's top youth volunteers. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan recently sat down with Warren to talk about the root causes of youth violence ahead of the second annual Peace Walk for his group, We Live Indy.
You became involved in the youth violence effort after a personal story.
Yeah, May of 2017, when I lost a friend and classmate of mine and a teammate of mine by the name of DeJohn Anderson, I was motivated to become active in the community. And I wanted to do something that created unity throughout the city, and Peace Walk was the first thing that really came to mind. You know, we're just trying to keep that same message and build that on top of the message of the youth violence that creates in the urban communities. We realize that this isn't just about school shootings or just urban community shootings. This is about all youth violence as a whole, from suicide to drug overdose and everything. We really just want to be vocal teenagers, and that's what we're just trying to build, vocal teenagers to speak up on the youth violence issues that's creating.
No, those issues can be so complicated and so, you know, deep-rooted. With your personal experience, you know, where did it go wrong at your high school and with your peers that something like this happened?
You know, the big things why I feel that shootings like this happen is because of the relationships that the victim or the students may have. One example is teacher-student relationship. I feel that is so powerful. Imagine if every teenager felt that they had someone behind them to support them. Imagine if every teenager had that influence that was constantly in their ear telling them right from wrong. With my friend, his mother speaks up on it all the time. She was a single mother, and she was working nights at the time, and it was really hard for her to be that influence in her son's ear, especially as he was a senior in high school and, you know, just leading with the wrong crowd at the wrong time. And that easily could have been guided a different direction.
Indianapolis heading for another record year of violence, and we so often hear, you know, that it's a 14-year-old, it's a 15-year-old.
I feel like I'm not the only teenager that's become numb to this. And when I have the feeling where I become numb to this and so used to it, and, you know, it's really hard to show emotions because, you know, I feel that it's no progress when you feel that way. But there's another side of me that tells me, you know, when we do peace marches, when we speak up on the issues, when we go to news interviews, when we are vocal, that's a small step forward.
The incident in Noblesville, and the reality that this can happen anywhere.
Man, we focus on this? You know, should we focus on mental health? Should we focus on, you know, getting the kids more resources? Should we focus on trying to find out where they're getting the guns? You know, so many different things. But I feel like the pillar of them all, the circle of them all, is actually talking to these kids, actually getting their lives. You know, a lot of the kids aren't going to be vocal unless you come to them.
Mm-hmm. How'd the walk go last year?
Man, it was great. You know, it was a hot day, but it was so powerful. You know, one of the most powerful things was hearing Mayor Hawks speak, Congressman Andre Carson, and really just the victimized families speak. And that was the most powerful thing to me last year, walking down Keystone and having the officers block off a section of the street while cars are still able to drive by and honk their horns and recognize us. Honestly, the most influential thing to me of the walk last year that will happen this year again, when we stopped in front of the juvenile center on 25th and Keystone, we had a real quick visual prayer word, because I want the kids to know inside. I want them to know that no matter what they're inside for, that they have a second or third or however many opportunity they have to get right and be with us outside eventually down the line.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Kidney failure is an expensive problem in the U.S. Dialysis, which removes toxins from the blood, costs taxpayers billions of dollars every year. But there's a cheaper dialysis option that's better for a lot of patients. Side Effects Public Media's Jake Harper explains why that other option isn't more common.
Boxes are piled high in Ann Hickman's hallway. Family photos peek out from behind the stacks in her one-bedroom Indianapolis apartment.
I got damn near 40 boxes sitting in the hall where I can't put up no Christmas decoration. I ain't no room.
Hickman says it's worth the tight squeeze. Those boxes hold the fluid she uses for peritoneal dialysis, or PD. While she sleeps, a machine pumps the fluid into her abdomen.
So it connects right in your belly?
Right here. It's connect right here.
And then it cycles the fluid through?
Four times. These things here be pumping and pumping and pumping, and it drain, fill, four times.
Toxins leach into the fluid during the process, and when she wakes up, the day is hers. Hickman is 74 and retired after a career in corrections. She stays busy working security at a local high school, and she has hobbies.
I go to bingo. I go to casino. I work puzzles. I crochet. I do everything to keep me happy.
And she's been able to keep that lifestyle even after her kidneys started to fail. She blames the naproxen she took for her arthritis. And when she needed to start dialysis last year, Hickman did not want to get standard hemodialysis.
You're weak, you're hungry, you're tired, you're sick.
Hemo patients travel to a clinic 3 times a week and spend hours there while a machine filters their blood. So when Hickman's doctors gave her a choice between hemo and peritoneal dialysis, it was a no-brainer.
I said, well, put me on that one. And that's what they did.
Hickman is unusual. Only 10% of patients get peritoneal dialysis, according to the most recent government report. But given the option, more patients might choose PD over hemo. PD patients have more freedom. They actually tend to live longer. And it's cheaper. It costs Medicare 15% less to treat a PD patient. So why isn't peritoneal dialysis more common? I put that question to Dr. Stephen Guest. He's medical director for Baxter, which makes dialysis supplies. And he wrote a clinical guide to PD. The answer?
Patients are just frankly not being told about a home dialysis option.
And what's driving that?
Well, let me go back.
In the 80s and 90s, many people were concerned that PD was riskier. Guest says Medicare reimbursement favored hemodialysis. The money was in hemo.
There's a lot of construction, a lot of building of dialysis units, and they need to fill the chairs.
Use of PD declined. And Guest says that affected how doctors were trained.
They were exposed less and less. Therefore, they may not have confidence prescribing it or even talking to patients about it.
So the industry has been slow to adjust, even as the research showed that PD is a good option. There are some signs of change. The number of people on peritoneal dialysis has increased. And in 2011, Medicare altered its reimbursement, which encouraged even more use of PD. But barriers remain. Dr. Melissa Anderson, a kidney doctor in Indianapolis, says physicians still make more money from hemo.
I can go to a clinic and I can see 20 or more patients in a few hours, and your billing and reimbursement is significantly higher.
And I mean, does that in your mind push doctors to keep people on hemodialysis when maybe they shouldn't be?
I think that would be tempting to do.
And patients themselves might not want PD. For instance, Anderson says she sees about 25 patients on hemodialysis. Do you think any of them could be switched?
Yeah.
But she says many of them have been on it for years.
And so they're very used to that, and they're comfortable with that.
Anderson says if they're told about it, new patients may choose PD over hemo. That's what Ann Hickman did.
You like this better?
Oh, hell yeah. One time a day. Well, at night. Love it. Yeah. For the simple reason, you ain't tied up.
Even at 74, without functioning kidneys, she says she can still do anything she wants to do. Jake Harper, Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The opportunity to go sailing on a semi-regular basis isn't as elusive as it may seem. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson has more. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson has more.
Sailing is now available to more socioeconomic classes than just the rich, thanks to a sharing business model. Sailtime Chicago is a shared boat membership company. Ryan Remsing is the fleet manager.
People pay for a season of using a boat here in Chicago. They have no ownership stake. They just pay for their time. They schedule it online, show up to the boat, and it's like they own it. So the boat's clean. It's ready to go. It has all the safety gear they need. They just start up the engine, have their fun, come back, clean up whatever mess they made, and they're all good.
Remsing, who started out in the business while he was a college student, scrubbing decks and doing various chores, knows the members and explains how the program works, making sailing more available to those who aren't necessarily rich.
Boating is very, you know, expensive, especially for, you know, the higher level boats that we offer. So with our membership package, you know, you really have a lot of variability in the package you could choose. We have options from $3,700 to $13,000, and that's all inclusive. So your insurance is covered, the slip fees are covered, gas is covered. So it really makes it a set cost that people can plan for and make a boat like this much more available for different socioeconomic classes.
The program also makes initial boat ownership easier on the owner.
The owner of that Beneteau Oceanus 31, her name's Mary. Her and her sister, after she got divorced, her and her sister decided that they wanted to buy a boat together, but they weren't sure about, you know, how to take care of a boat, what to do. You know, it was kind of a big step for them. So they bought it through our program, and, you know, I'm taking care of it, kind of teaching her the ropes, you know, of boat ownership. And, you know, she gets to go out, sail with her sister, and let me handle all the work when it comes to it. So every boat in our fleet is owned by a single owner like Mary. She, you know, puts it in our fleet, puts it in our care, and we really take care of everything for 5 to 6 years. You know, we'll do all the engine maintenance, we'll take care of the sails and winterizing it in the fall and getting it ready in the spring. You know, there's a lot of work that goes in. So for the boat owner, it works great for them because they're getting the sail, they have their boat, and they kind of get a long intro into becoming a boat owner. Right? After those 5, 6 years, they're kind of used to the program. They've learned a few things from me. They know their boat real well. And now they can, you know, go off on their own. But in the meantime, they save thousands of dollars every year and didn't have to do all that work.
What do you get out of it, though?
So we share it with the other people, and we share the revenue 50-50. So 50% of the revenue on Mary's boat comes to me and the company. 50% goes to her to help cover costs like her insurance and her slip. And then anything on top of that, she'll get payments directly from us. So she'll make a few thousand dollars this year to apply to her boat loan while not having any sort of, you know, operational or maintenance costs.
So do you take each boat just for 5 years?
Yeah, so it's an initial. They look amazing. So it's an initial 3-year contract. And then if the boat's doing well and the owner's happy, we're making money, everything's going great, then yeah, we'll go 5 or 6 years. Usually the owners will get real upset when they have to leave because they get so used to it. You know, they're getting out sailing enough. They don't need to go anymore. And, you know, they like having everything taken care of. For them, it's like a concierge service. They show up in the spring, their boat's ready to go. They didn't have to waste a weekend or two getting it prepped.
Sailtime Chicago also offers an educational component. Remsing's father is the owner of the business, which started in 2005. Remsing, who is now 33, became a sailing instructor when he was 25 years old.
You
they have an education program here too, where you go through like a sailing 101 up through more advanced classes and teaching people how to navigate further on down the line.
Yes, yeah, so we're an ASA certified sailing school. That's the American Sailing Association. So when you start out with us, even if you've never been out on a boat, you're going to get some, you know, basic training, get you comfortable just taking a group of friends out for the day. Every member gets a full one-day checkout on their boat, so they know where all the safety gear is, they know where all the through hulls are, and they feel comfortable taking that boat out. But we also offer courses, you know, that are more advanced, even going up to an overnight lake crossing, which is, you know, very advanced.
So what are you doing now? Just untying the boat?
Yep. So I'm untying all the dock lines. This is something we go through with the members, kind of identifying where the wind's coming from, how we're going to leave the slip, because really most of the most difficult part of sailing is docking. Right?
Oh, okay.
That's where all the damage happens. That's where all the yelling happens. So we really go through a lot of training with that, just to make it more stress-free and prevent damage.
So what does it take to get a sailing license?
ASA 101 basic keel boat is really the bare minimum that you want to be able to go out. And we teach that as a two-day course on one of our boats. There's a maximum of 4 students, so everyone gets a lot of time, you know, at the wheel and working the winches. We send out books ahead of time so you can kind of do some study, become familiar, and then it's all hands-on work once we're on the boat.
What are winches?
Winches would be like this guy right here. So when we pull a line and we can't pull it any tighter with our hands, we use a winch and just crank on it to get the lines even tighter. So you'll see me do that when we raise the sail once we're out on the lake. Just as far as this boat, it's a Gemini Freestyle 37. It's a really unique kind of design in that it's a catamaran, a sailboat, but they've really removed almost all the cabins and everything and made it just an open day party boat, which is great for around here where, you know, we don't do much cruising. There isn't, you know, you don't go cruising with 3 couples and stay on board every night. It really is just day sailing and, you know, enjoying the day.
So what are you doing there?
So these are all my lines that control the sail. They all come back to the wheel, so one person can really operate the boat without any issue. So what I'm doing is just getting the lines ready for me to hoist up. First thing we're going to do once we get out on the lake is raise the main halyard to bring the main sail up. So you'll see a nice big sail go up from the back of the mast, and that'll be our main power once we turn off our engines. Okay, so what we're going to do now, we're going to turn directly into the wind, right? So the bow of the boat is right on the wind, and now we're going to raise our main sail while staying directly into the wind.
So you guys put your logo, obviously, on the boat once you enter in the partnership?
Yeah, so we put it up at the bow. You know, it's a little bit of marketing for us, but it's also nice because it tells the other boaters on the dock when they're coming in, you know, this isn't this person's boat. They might be new to boating. And the nice thing about boaters is, you know, everyone will come down and help someone dock. You know, they'll come down, just grab a line, help pull you in, which is awesome for our members because now they're getting that bit of help. And it's just that boating community. Everyone watches after each other.
For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Time to check in with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. She's a very busy person these days, in particular about one place that she has been spending a lot of time, and that is the Indiana State Fairgrounds. And Lieutenant Governor Crouch, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my goodness. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Well, we know that the state fair is underway. They're going to be continuing on till the through the 19th of August. You've already been out at the fairgrounds in Indianapolis to visit and talk with people. Give us an idea of how things are going in your estimation and what things that you've been covering since you are in charge of Indiana's Department of Agriculture.
Well, thank you. Yes, as Secretary of Agriculture and Rural Development, it is my favorite time of the year. Being at the state fair, being able to enjoy
interacting with people from ag, our ag partners, and as you know, agriculture is a big contributor to Indiana's thriving economy, contributing $31 billion to our gross domestic product. So, you know, when I go out to the fair and I interact with people in agriculture, it is truly the best that Indiana has to offer. These people are the salt of the earth. They're the people that put food on our tables and feed people all over the globe. And so, of course, the theme this year is Step Right Up. It's a circus theme, and I had the opportunity to visit the Big Top Circus on opening day. I had pork breakfast, been to Animal Farm, which is a new feature where people can actually interact with the animals that are there at the fair. I've kind of been eating my way across State Fair, so there's something for everyone.
A lot of people do that, so that's the nice thing. You can go to the State Fair and you can just about find every single meal that you would ever want to imagine eating at the fair there in the Midway. So that's the idea, is to take advantage of the great things. I know a lot of these are items that are put together by people that grown and operated in Indiana. In fact, that was one of the projects or the days coming up here at the fair. We know that the Lieutenant Governor has a specific celebration of Agriculture Day, as well as you get a chance to participate in the Indiana Grown activities as well, too. Tell us about those two projects, please.
Well, Indiana Grown is a branding project, a branding program that was instituted by the Indiana State Department of Agriculture. And what we do is we brand products that are grown, produced, or processed here in Indiana. So we connect those products to the consumer through shelves in stores or through farmers markets or through any number of opportunities, because the consumer truly is interested in what they are consuming these days. Mm-hmm. They have confidence that those products that are produced and grown and processed in Indiana are good products. And so we feature all of our Indiana, not all, but many of our Indiana grown products at our Indiana grown marketplace at the State Fair. And we have, this program was started some 3 years ago and has already 1,200 plus members.
Wow.
There's no cost to belong. But when you do belong, then the Indiana State Department of Agriculture will promote and help market your products and connect you to the consumers that are interested in purchasing them. So it's been a successful program, and I would encourage everyone who's visiting the State Fair to go to the Indiana Grown Marketplace and experience the best of what Indiana has to offer. Oh, well, the Celebration of Agriculture, yeah. That is an opportunity to really showcase what we have to offer in Indiana, whether we do it through our exhibits, whether we do it through our interactions, and the circus theme runs throughout the fair this year. The Girl Scouts have a circus theme. When you go to the exhibit halls, they all have a circus theme. And here is what I learned, mm-hmm. which I didn't know, that Indiana was one of the states that had more winter circus farms than any other state in the country, because of our rail, because of us being centrally located. We had many communities throughout the state that actually served as winter headquarters for circuses throughout the United States. And so we have a rich history in circus here in Indiana, and we're celebrating it at the State Fair this year.
That's right.
Step right up and come out and enjoy all that we have to offer at the Indiana State Fair.
Well, certainly the people in Peru, which is, I know, of course, that's where the Circus Museum is located. It's open, I think, all year round, and they do very special things during the summer months, too, up there. But it's interesting that they should bring that theme to Indianapolis and expand it through the fair this year in particular. One of the other things I'd like to ask about, too, is the latest announcement that came out from the Department of Agriculture about the distribution of funds for 11 regional food banks, including the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. Tell us about that, please.
You know, being able to feed the hungry throughout Indiana, and it's hard for many of us to believe that there are families that go hungry and there are children that go hungry throughout Indiana. And so our food banks serve as a opportunity to get food to those individuals, and the state supports it with a $300,000 grant to our food banks to allow them to help feed those people and meet that need that is out there in Indiana. We will work to hopefully increase that in the future, but we are happy to be able to provide some assistance to our food banks. They are serving such an incredibly important need here in the state of Indiana. And I am particularly excited about coming up and visiting your new food bank in Merivale, which you were telling me about earlier.
That's right. The food bank is relocated from its old location in Gary into a big, big, big place, much bigger than I think that they could ever imagine, but they need the space. They're on Broadway in Merivale, so it's worth checking out. And they've worked very hard and continuing to work hard on their campaign to raise money to be able to do what they want to do with the facility and to help people out, and the food bank in particular helping out the food pantries that they service here in Northwest Indiana. One of the other things, getting back to farmers here and the farm theme during the state fair, is the latest situation involving the U.S. Tariff situation and the impact that it has on farmers here in Indiana. Tell us the latest, if you will.
Well, as you know, we are extremely concerned about the tariff talk and the effect that will have on our Indiana agriculture exports, because we export the majority of our agriculture products, and that serves as a marketplace for our products and for our farmers. And so we want trade, not aid. We want to know that we have markets open and available, that we can freely trade our products. And so we are appreciative that those agreements that are 30-some years old need to be modernized. We understand the need for that, but it is working, and we don't want to end up with anything that penalizes and further stresses our Indiana agriculture farmers. So we continue to communicate with our trade representatives and our congressional partners, letting them know. In fact, it was done as recently as the pork breakfast last week, letting them know the importance of having free trade and being able to have those markets available for our Indiana agriculture products. We are hopeful that this will resolve in action that is beneficial to us, but we will continue to advocate. In fact, I am meeting I think it's next week with our Undersecretary of Trade, our former Indiana State Department of Agriculture Director, Ted McKinney. And I will anxiously look forward to hearing what he has to share on our trade situation and the tariff situation.
And finally, Lieutenant Governor Crouch, let's get an update here. I know recently the information came out at a very special Indiana Supreme Court opioid symposium, and I know that you and Governor Holcomb have been working extra hard in the battle against opioid addiction and the crisis that Indiana faces. Tell us a little bit more about this opioid symposium that was recently held and the efforts that the state government's trying to do to fight the battle.
Well, the reason this is so important is our fourth pillar. We have five pillars that we believe will take Indiana to the next level, and they are about enriching Hoosiers' lives and putting people first. And our fourth pillar is fighting the opioid epidemic, because we can't allow our citizens and our Hoosiers to fall further into the clutches of despair. We have to fight it on all levels: prevention, enforcement, and treatment. And we are doing that. Governor Holcomb's first day in office, he named a drug czar, Jim McClellan, who's hit the ground running. One out of five Hoosiers face mental illness or are suffering from addiction. And it is the leading cause of Americans under the age of 50. So these symposiums that we are having all over the state are bringing stakeholders together and individuals together to dedicate resources, all hands on deck, to be able to resolve this issue and to resolve this problem, because that's what it's going to take. I was so touched to be able to hear the story of a woman, Shirley Wagner, who lost her grandson due to the opioid addiction. And it was heartrending and touching. And she said she was there because she doesn't want other families to go through what they have gone through. That is the
kind of dedication and commitment we are seeing all over the state. And it's going to take everyone if we're going to defeat this enemy. This issue affects every social, economic, and age group. We're seeing mothers give birth to babies that are addicted. We are seeing people test positive at work, or employers can't hire people because they can't pass drug tests. So it is one of our top priorities, and we are facing this issue with our fellow Hoosiers, and we will be successful, but only because we will all be dedicated and committed to defeating this enemy.
Lieutenant Governor Crouch, thank you very much for spending time with us, telling us the latest about these topics of interest that come out of Indianapolis. And I guess it's not too trite to say we'll see you at the state fairgrounds sometime, I would imagine.
Well, step right up.
That's Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.